Good evening. I'm Catherine Loper, news director for WRVO Public Media. We are pleased to bring you the third in a series of community forums on health topics, sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. Today we are at St. Elizabeth's Medical Center in Utica, and our topic of discussion is mental health care in upstate New York. It's estimated that one in five families in the United States and in New York State will be affected by mental illness. And treating mental health and mental illness is an equally big issue. Mental health is a huge umbrella description for a variety of specific diseases and disorders, everything from depression and bipolar disorder to substance abuse and eating disorders, and even post-traumatic stress disorder. Changing state and federal budgets, changes in the healthcare system, and changes in cultural attitudes toward mental illness have all resulted in an ever-evolving system for treating these issues. On the federal level, the Affordable Care Act, and before that, the Mental Health Parity Act, have expanded health insurance coverage for many with mental health issues. But recent reports suggest that as many as 4 million Americans with serious mental illnesses remain uninsured. And in New York State, a new comprehensive plan to consolidate treatment centers and offer more community-based services will change the mental health treatment system in our region in the future. And here in Utica, the presence of the Mohawk Valley Psychiatric Center has made mental health care an issue of concern to this community for years. But how mental illness is treated or not treated can impact many aspects of our society and touch all of us. So today we will explore the system of mental health care in upstate New York, the history behind it, and what the state of the system is today and the changes we can all expect in the future. Helping us sort through this very large subject, we have three expert regional panelists. I want to welcome Linda Nelson. She's with the New York State Office of Mental Health. She's the Central New York Field Office Director. Linda has been in community service for 30 years and was one of the first credentialed alcoholism and substance abuse counselors in New York State. For 8 years, she served right here in Oneida County as the commissioner of the county's Department of Mental Health, and she was named Central New York Field Office Director for the state agency in September 2013. And we have Matthew Shapiro. He's with the New York State chapter of NAMI, which is the National Alliance on Mental Illness. He's the development and event coordinator and has worked for NAMI New York State since 2008. NAMI's mission is providing support, education, and advocacy for people living with mental illness and their families, and also disseminating the latest science-based mental health information. As a family member of someone with mental illness, Matthew has a personal perspective on the challenges faced by family, friends, and caregivers of those who live with psychiatric diseases. And we're also joined by Sean Johnston, who's right here from St. Elizabeth's Medical Center. She's a licensed master social worker and works as a mental health supportive care manager. She provides mental health evaluations as well as individual, family, and group therapy to both children and adults, primarily in the emergency department, but also hospital-wide. So we want to get started. I want to ask all of you, and we'll go down the line, and maybe, Linda, we can start with you. I want you to just explain briefly, you know, what you think the current state of mental health care is in upstate New York, which we're going to focus on today, and what some of the biggest challenges are.
The mental health system currently is improving, I'm happy to report, and it's transforming. Primarily, it is transforming from an institutional-based care system to one that is community-based with all the components to support individuals to live in the community. That's the biggest shift. It's really reflected in the state budget. $1.7 million will be reinvested right here in this region to make this shift. The expansion of community-based services is exciting, and people sometimes don't know what community-based services really encompass. It's housing, it's employment opportunities, it's peer supports, it's more care coordination, it's crisis intervention. So there's really a very full array of community-based reinvestments that are going to occur.
And Matthew, if you want to give you a little bit of your assessment.
I echo a lot of what Susan says. As from the advocacy side, we really feel that this was the best mental health budget we've seen in years. I mean, literally 20 years. And the last time, 20 years ago, when we saw a great reduction in psychiatric units across the state, we were promised an investment in the community services that Susan spoke about, but they weren't really delivered. And looking at this year's budget, it's very exciting. We actually got more than we had advocated for, which is exciting, per bed closure. Something else that Susan mentioned that we're also very, very encouraged about is there was money in the line for increased crisis intervention teams throughout New York State, which train police officers how to handle situations when they come encounter with someone living with a mental illness and to make sure they're treated properly with respect. And there's a very successful model, the Memphis model, that's reduced harm to people living with a psychiatric illness as well as police officers. So we're very excited that that's going to be coming to New York. We're also, excited. We believe, mental illness, there isn't one mental illness. It's such a broad spectrum. And as the way it is now, even within a disease, when people think schizophrenia, they think it's one disease, but it's many diseases. And so, we're glad to see that there's community services available as well as still the psychiatric units, because the people who are the sickest need those units, but the people who can recover in the community need to be given every tool to do so. And things like Susan said, the job training, education, rehabilitation, and peer services. So we're very excited by what this budget holds for us.
Great. And Sean, as someone who's on the front lines, how would you assess where upstate New York is with mental health services now?
Well, I also agree with what Linda is saying. I do see, on the front line that the system is overwhelmed by the demand, and the community-based services seem sometimes a little fragmented among various providers. There's challenges in getting what we consider from, a crisis or acute setting, timely access to a lot of things, specifically psychiatry, inpatient substance abuse, supportive housing. Accessing those things can still take a long time with the overwhelming demand on those services with wait lists. And so definitely improving, but, we still feel a lot of the pressure of trying to get those things for people.
And Linda, to pick up on one of the things you said there's a transition going on now and probably has been going on for years, but you can tell me from the inpatient service to that community-based. And is that the sort of the old legacy historically of treating mental illness was that really that inpatient? Is that correct?
Institutionalization was the norm.
Right.
And it's time to make that change. The system cannot sustain itself for a number of reasons, but there's really moral and clinical and best practice lessons that we've learned. It is time to make the shift. We know we can, and we know we must. There's legal mandates, such as the Olmstead Act, which requires us to serve individuals in a most integrative setting. So there's monetary reasons, there's really moral reasons, there's legal reasons to do this, but there will always be a need for some some beds. And we do have a long way to go, as Sean said. We really do have work to do.
Sean, are there certain things that you think are the biggest challenge in making that transition from where the norm was, the standard was just throw somebody in the hospital to what you're trying to get to with community-based services?
Yeah. I believe the housing is a big, big challenge, and we have a large population of people that need a supportive housing environment, group housing with lots of services within that setting. And there's typically quite a wait list for people to get those things. And sometimes there's no other appropriate level of housing, and people wait sometimes a very long time on an inpatient unit for that reason, which is unfortunate. Inpatient substance abuse treatment is difficult, including detox. Finding beds for that and then getting it approved by insurance is a challenge. And also, many people, I think, that would be typical for the long-term inpatient setting often have components of their disorder that lead them to be very non-compliant and lack of follow-through and burn a lot of bridges, so to say. So for that population, it sometimes is difficult to still get them services because, they've not completed a lot of things and dropped out a lot of things, and so people, don't want to see them in that kind of situation. That's still pretty difficult to manage.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the third in a series of community health forums on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director, and today we're discussing the state of mental health care in upstate New York. And Matthew, with the National Alliance on Mental Illness, I know your group's, one of your missions is to educate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think probably one of the things about the changing nature of the way we treat mental illness in this country, in this state, is the changing nature of the stigma around it. Educating people about mental disease, mental illness, and has probably, you tell me, has led to hopefully a less stigma. Are you seeing it a little bit? And that goes hand in hand with why the attitude of not just putting everyone in the hospital.
Right. Obviously, you are correct. That is our main mission, as well as supporting people living with a mental illness, giving them education, support, as well as their families and providers of mental health services. We really are trying to educate the public on the realities of mental illness and change the face of mental illness. And obviously, it's been a little challenging over the last couple of years when we see these tragedies in Newton and Colorado, and people just associate mental illness with violence, which is a great myth. It's such a low percentage. In fact, someone who is adhering to treatment who has a mental illness, schizophrenia, is much more likely to be the victim of a crime and not a perpetrator of a crime. But along with these tragedies, NIMH Director Tom Insel says this is actually a time of great opportunity because the dialogue is open and people might be scared, but they're willing to listen because they want to know the truth. So that's really where we're kind of at with educating the public on the realities of what living with a mental illness is. And, one of the things, too, it's very stigmatizing for the families, too. Something we hear a lot in NAMI is when people have cancer or when a relative has cancer, the community runs to you. When they hear you have a relative with mental illness, they run away from you. So that's certainly something we're trying to reverse, that trend of thinking, and not just with the general public, but like I said, we provide a lot of education to teachers, the education system, school administrators, as well as providers of mental health services.
Linda, I wanted to turn to you because I think maybe some people who have known people with mental illness or some families, when they first encounter mental illness, their first instinct is to go to their doctor. They go a private route. And I was really surprised at how large, the State Office of Mental Health really is and how far-reaching and how many different things you do. If you could just talk for a moment about the role of the Office of Mental Health and the changes in the reorganization plan as well.
Yes, the state of New York really is the primary provider of mental health services in the state of New York. And people don't often realize that. They just see these albatross institutions and think that's it, where in fact institutionalization is a piece of it. The rest of it really is prevention, intervention types of models. The oversight of the licensed programs. Here at this hospital, there is an inpatient unit that is monitored and overseen by the state of New York. But the non-licensed programs are also overseen and monitored by the state of New York, such as the housing components, which incidentally, in the new realignment, is the first shot at massive expansion. Because we can't de-bed or take down beds unless we have a place for people to live. Mm-hmm. So that component is really almost well-developed and will be rolled out very shortly. So the system, the mental health system, the public system really is the underpinnings of a safety net for many people, and it comes in many forms. So each county, the local government unit, is really responsible and charged with, under mental hygiene law, for the planning and the provision of what's needed. That funding will remain the same this year. So county contracts, the 501c3s that have county contracts, can and in most cases will continue. They provide the most of the services. So these wonderful local agencies we have are really mostly funded by the Office of Mental Health, sometimes OASIS, Office of Alcoholism and Substance Abuse, or the Office of Persons with Developmental Disabilities. So the counties bring all of these resources together and really determine the needs in a community. And that's how the planning process and strategic plans are developed. In the new realignment plan, many of that stays the same. Of course, housing initially is the big first move, followed by home and community-based waivers for children. Okay, these are intensive wraparound supports to keep children out of institutions and to support families in children's recoveries. This is proven science. In our system, we kind of delineate children from 0 to 12 as being children, and then adolescents 13 to either 18, sometimes up to 21. So we have these two camps. Services for children are different than services for adults in New York State based on needs. Most children enter state facilities due to aggression, either towards themselves or others. So children's mental illness is often manifested in behaviors, okay, different than adults. The new realignment plan takes all of that into consideration. The development of community-based stabilization teams. Many communities have mobile treatment assessment teams. This takes this even a step further, where the role really is to intervene early and prevent a presentation to the ED. I mean, if we can keep them out of the emergency departments, head them off even from hitting those doors, we've made monumental strides. But we can't just turn them back into a revolving system. We have to ensure that those supports are there to divert and allow a person to get healthy in a natural setting.
And we'll talk more about the reorganization, I'm sure, as we go on. But okay. You brought up the emergency department, and Sean, that's where you do the primary bulk of your work. And is that really, I mentioned, you know, some people may just start out with their family physician if there's a problem, but are you encountering people who maybe have mental health issues who've never, you know, dealt with a medical professional before in the ER?
Yes, today actually. yes, it really runs the gamut where we have people who are in frequent contact for a long, long time, and then people who've never seen a mental health professional ever, or even maybe even don't have a primary care doctor and don't know what to do.
And how do you interact with the state office? I mean, what does that look like, and how does that work?
Well, from the ER, in that scenario, I don't know that there is a direct interaction with the state office. If the person goes from the ER to the psychiatric unit and they're admitted, you know, that might be different. But if the person doesn't require hospitalization, you know, we set them up with treatment appointments and follow-up, and then they're discharged back home, there wouldn't really be any communication there.
Right. And obviously there's, you know, a support system here in the hospital. Mm-hmm. But then I think it's important to talk about the role that, Matthew, that nonprofits and other support organizations play. And if there are, a variety of places in upstate New York that people can go to for resources. Can you mm-hmm. speak to that?
Sure. From the NAMI perspective, you know, we offer all sorts of support and education. And one of the things that we've done is provide emergency rooms and psychiatric emergency rooms with what we call, we actually co-produced it with the Office of Mental Health, is our Family Mental Health Survival Toolkit, which is a three-component kit, including what we call the Family Handbook, which gives people everything you need to know about communicating with both your loved one, their doctors, the system, how to get them services. It's a 60-page kind of all-encompassing book. We also offer, for families, we offer various programs, including our 12-week family-to-family program, which is the only evidence-based program that provides support to families of people living with a mental illness. It's a 12-week course taught by other family members who are trained to give the course. And basically, much like the handbook, kind of guides you through really what mental illness is, explain that a lot of them are biological diseases like any other disease. A disease of the brain is no different than a disease of any other organ, and kind of walks them through communication strategies, coping strategies, information and finding resources. We also have our Basics program, which is for parents of children living with a mental illness. That's a six-week course, and it gives these families the information on how to communicate to schools or doctors, what are the right questions you should be asking. And really, both those courses have been called life transformative experiences for people who take them. Those are some of the things that we offer.
And I know that there's a million different things that are offered by other groups as well as yours, and there are groups here in this community and all throughout upstate New York that provide support system. And I don't want to leave out the role of law enforcement, because often they're first responders for mental illness as well as what we would traditionally think of. Does anyone want to talk about the role, how important that piece of the puzzle is?
Law enforcement are critical and vital partners here. Under mental hygiene law, they actually have very specific duties under 941 and 945, which is around transporting individuals. If a call comes into 911 and law enforcement is dispatched and it's determined that the individual in need could possibly have something more going on than meets the eye, and an evaluation is needed, an officer can transport under 941 law to a 939 hospital, which is equipped to do evaluations, like St. Elizabeth's and St. Luke's here. The 945 law requires that the county commissioner or a designated individual, in fact, concurs that further evaluation is needed and institutes that pickup order. So law enforcement is critical. Most police officers, when they start training in police academy, are offered mental health curriculum as part of their initial training because it is so much a part of their day-to-day work. And that curriculum, most of that is provided by trained mental health providers. But law enforcement are, vital partners, and we need to support them. They do support us, and we welcome any opportunity to bridge that relationship.
Mm-hmm. And Matthew, I know we talked about the social workers in the hospital being on the front line, but obviously family members are really, truly most on the front line and maybe are the first ones to notice an issue or a problem. If you want to talk a little bit about the role that family members play and how important that is and how that can sort of make or break a person's treatment.
Sure. I mean, one thing we really believe in, we try to promote, is that to really have a successful recovery, you need a recovery team. It's kind of a triangle with obviously the person living with the mental illness on top, and then the family member and their care provider all working together. I mean, as I talked about before when talking about peer-to-peer, there are always bumps in the road in recovery from mental illness, and family members should be that first safety net, ideally. And, you know, a lot of our families want to be as involved as possible with their loved ones' recovery and support them. I mean, we have, you know, amazing families in NAMI who really have sacrificed so much for their loved ones and to make sure, you know, they're really, like you say, on the front lines, whether it's fighting for safe and affordable housing, which is one of our main advocacy issues, or fighting to make sure they get their right medications or the right treatment options. And we think families play a very, very vital role. And, you know, we really see the most successful recoveries as being a part of a team.
Mm-hmm. And Sean, I know you mentioned as one of the challenges, sometimes insurance can be a challenge. Mm-hmm. How would you describe, have you seen any changes in that? How do you deal with that as a stumbling block to getting every people the correct treatment?
Well, I think it has changed in the, you know, the current economic environment, insurance environment. Insurance companies are really kind of tightening up their approvals. And I think it's more demands on justifying levels of care and duration of care and different levels of treatment. And also we're having lengthier discussions with clinical people that work for insurance companies about the types of treatment people are getting and whether or not it's, you know, evidence-based and what the outcomes are going to be. They're getting much more involved with those types of issues, you know, I guess to ensure they're getting, you know, the most bang for their buck. And they're questioning discharge plans and making sure that everybody's getting everything they need when, you know, when they leave the hospital. So it's definitely much more involvement on the insurance company's part in all of those things.
So it's interesting. There's a little bit of a, on one side with the stigma and going down hopefully a little bit and awareness getting better, that affects it on one side. But then, you know, there's more justification needed and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing is, yes. as more people are getting insured too.
Yes.
I mean, also Medicaid, Medicare.
Right.
Actually, on April 24th coming up, there's the Drug Utilization Review meeting in Albany where they actually meet to review what drugs Medicaid and Medicare will cover for someone living with a mental illness. Now, of course, NAMI New York State will advocate that there should be a total open access to medication. Antipsychotic drugs can't be interchanged. You know, so that's one thing we fight for. Obviously, generics sometimes don't work as well as regulars for on mental illness, antidepressants and antipsychotics. So it goes really beyond the insurance companies, too, that we want to make sure, like Sean said, they want to make sure everything is evidence-based. And you know, with insurance parity now, there's a lot of things we're excited about, but there are some things that we're also worried about. Things like peer services aren't evidence-based mm-hmm. and may not be insured. So it's, you know, always things like that that we're really concerned about.
And Medicaid and Medicare are definitely part of the picture, and the Affordable Care Act has become part of the picture. And Linda, maybe if you, none of us are experts on the Affordable Care Act here, and it's such a huge thing, but I think there are certain ways we are seeing that affect the number of people being covered and, you know, the way coverage is being provided, that sort of thing. How are you seeing it change the system here?
The Affordable Care Act really expands coverage for mental health and substance abuse. That's the bottom line. It really builds on that Mental Health Parity and Addictions Equity Act of 2008.
Can we explain that a little bit if you want to define that?
That was really extended parity to 62 million Americans, which meant that it had to be paid at the same rate that other medical conditions were being charged. That's where the parity came in. Sometimes you've heard of it maybe as Timothy's Law. Mm-hmm. So the Affordable Care Act really does expand this. And we're talking about 62 million Americans being covered. So it's significant.
Right. And, yeah. you know, that we mentioned, you know, it's a very approximate 1 in 5 families affected. That's very, very approximate. But if you think about the number of people who are now being mm-hmm. insured that weren't, you know, all those numbers play
in. The other piece with that is that in 2011, the Medicaid Redesign Behavioral Health Work Group really fundamentally restructured the Medicaid program to achieve measurable improvements in health outcomes. Things had to be measured. No longer could a bill be submitted to a Medicaid that was unsubstantiated. The outcomes and accountability really were increased, which everyone agreed is a good idea to check what you're paying for. But the integration of physical health and behavioral health became primary. You know, let's see how these two worlds really interplay and address the entire wellness of the individual. Patient choice became primary, which is welcome. And then tying the payments to the outcomes was really the biggest change. So, you know, other systems like Department of Health and OASIS, the alcohol and substance abuse world, really had to collaborate to show that care was well coordinated and is. So that's an improvement in Medicaid delivery.
And you mentioned something that there's a lot more outcome-based, and we're seeing that in private insurance as well. But the flip side of that is that it's sometimes hard to prove because mental illness is such a nebulous thing sometimes. Is it hard to prove those outcomes, and does that ever prevent treatment?
I know that it's sometimes anecdotally, everybody involved with a person understands that what you're asking for is going to be the best shot at working. I guess the best example I can think of is an inpatient substance abuse treatment you're requesting. where the insurance company may say, no, you have to have 3 failed attempts at outpatient mm-hmm. before, you know, we'll approve that. And so, you know, there's a person there who maybe already did that, but it's not documented because it was a different insurance or has been so chronic for so long, you know they need to be inpatient, but
you have
for
to
whatever reason
steps.
That the insurance company decided that, you know, if there's an evidence base behind that, yeah, they have to fail for a much longer period of time than anybody wants to see them in order to get it.
And is that what you see as well, Matthew?
Yeah, I mean, these fail-first policies are something, obviously, that's very scary to us. It's kind of penny-wise and pound-foolish. I think, you know, these fail-first policies are leading to more people with a mental illness in emergency rooms, worst-case scenarios in the criminal justice system. I mean, we see recidivism within people with mental illness who aren't getting the right treatment that they need right away. So fail-first policies are something that's just obviously we're very against and it's very scary to us.
I wanted to go back to something you all were mentioning earlier about this year's budget. There's a sort of a consensus here at this table that being a better for mental health than in some years past. What are the budget challenges? I mean, we know that upstate New York, New York State, the economy's not been great in the last few years, but there's a sense of coming out of that state and that some services are getting funded that hadn't been funded before. And maybe, Linda, you could just briefly describe sort of where we're at with the budget, and maybe the other two of you could weigh in on where we would like to be.
There are funds immediately available to reinvest. We don't have to wait a year to start the process, which is the good news. We do need to get these enhanced community services up and running. We need to show that they're effective. And it's not an easy thing to redesign a system. There are funding mechanisms available for the first time through the Department of Health, which will be used in tandem with Office of Mental Health. One is this large DSRIP funding, which stands for Delivery System Reform Initiative. And that really is a new force, a new initiative. It's $8 billion savings from Medicaid redesign, which is going to be reinvested for sustainable systemic use. It has to continue without public funding. Sustainable change for transformation. A huge component is a decrease in inpatient use. To be eligible for these funds, you have to prove that you have diverted inpatient admissions. And there's money for vital safety net. And it really is available for hospital units that are vulnerable and at risk for closing because of monetary reasons. So the minute a hospital or facility feels they can't continue, if they notify us, we can work in tandem to get some other non-traditional types of funding. And those are all in the budget and ready to roll out.
Now, Linda, as the Central New York Field Office Director, I was surprised you have such a large region. You said 20 counties,
yes.
Is that right? I mean, so for the Office of Mental Health purposes, Central New York goes from the southern tier to the Canadian border. Mm-hmm. Down the middle of the state. And I know that there have got to be certain challenges of delivering mental health services in rural areas. And I think that's part of the reason we saw, some outcry over certain mm-hmm. psychiatric centers, you know, talking about them being shut down. What are those challenges for those rural areas where you're not like here in Utica, where you're in a metropolitan center? What are those unique challenges for rural families?
Geography is the culprit here in terms of miles. Families now are forced to travel a great distance. Luckily, the Department of Health recognizes this in their state plan as well as Office of Mental Health. So anything we can do to bring care to the individuals as opposed to having them travel is on the agenda and really is working. If we can get primary care and behavioral health to be served at the same location, that's a good start. Mm-hmm. Any integration of services so families don't have to travel and have 3 appointments instead of 1, that would be helpful. The Department of Health is on the same page with OMH. serving the client at home, getting services into the home, all kinds of monitoring using technology. That is the direction we're moving in.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to the third in a series of community health forums on WRVO Public Media. I'm Catherine Loper, WRVO News Director, and today we are discussing the state of mental health care in upstate New York. And you just brought up telemedicine, which I wanted to sort of turn to the things we can, hopefully see in the future. And, you know, Sean, as someone on the front lines, are there ways you think that telemedicine or other technologies could really help with delivery of care?
Yeah, you know, I wonder if most people are far more comfortable with it than the providers themselves might be. You know, as part of what I do being psychotherapy, it's a little difficult to think about, you know, not being face-to-face with somebody and providing treatment. There's so many nuances to working with someone as far as body language and, you know, all of that. But I definitely see a huge benefit for that, especially with, I think, psychiatry. If that was more accessible, like Linda's saying, within primary care offices or for rural populations that can't get to that appointment, because that would definitely fill a big gap.
Matthew, did you want to weigh in on both the issue of, you know, traveling and distances and, you know, how hopefully telemedicine will fit into that?
Sure. NAMI believes that no one should have to travel more than 1 hour to get to an emergency room or a crisis unit. So obviously the challenges posed to rural counties, I mean, we see that every day. Just we have, you know, 47 affiliates throughout the state, and a lot of them are in rural counties. You know, like our affiliate president in Delaware County points out, Delaware County is larger than the state of Rhode Island, and you have two kind of metropolitan areas on opposite sides of the county. So anyone stuck in the middle is really challenging. You know, we're optimistic about what telemedicine and video medicine is. Actually, a few projects we've tried doing with OMH, especially for people in forensic facilities whose families are from out of state and can't visit. I mean, you don't get the same power of having a face-to-face consultation with a doctor. I think the most successful recoveries happen when there's a real trusting relationship that's built between the care provider and the person receiving care. And I think that type of relationship, it's hard to copy that without being face-to-face. But for people who don't have any other options, you know, we are optimistic about where that could lead, but shouldn't be considered a replacement for face-to-face therapy.
We certainly saw difficulty traveling this winter, that's for sure. So I think there are pros and cons because, like you said, some people may feel more comfortable being in their own home talking about these issues, but you don't get that face-to-face interface. I want to wrap up with two separate things, and I want to ask each of you. First of all, I mean, we've been kind of talking about this as a mental health care system and talking about the various parts of the system. Just to get down to the real consumer nitty-gritty, if you are a family member who has someone who you think is suffering from mental health issues, of all the things we've talked about, the government agencies, the private support, private hospitals, you know, community organizations, what are the best places for people to start if they're just entering the system for the first time? What would your advice be? And I'll go down the line and maybe start with you, Sean.
Well, I feel like the best place to start, if you have an established good relationship with your primary care doctor, would be there. I think that person would hopefully be the best to guide you to the next step. You know, do they need to start you with a medication? The least level of intervention to start with, as long as the person is safe, obviously. Or do you need a referral? Are you acutely in crisis? Do you need to go to the ER and your doctor can direct you from there? If you don't have primary care, you don't have that kind of relationship, you know, there's lots of numbers available in this county. We have mobile crisis assessment team that can come see you. They can direct you. They can make referrals and get you appointments. I'm sure NAMI has numbers where you can call and get guidance. And obviously, if you can't do any of those things, there's always the ER.
And Matthew?
Well, I mean, I pretty much agree with everything Sean just said. Having a doctor that you trust, a family physician who knows the family for a long time, if you have that, obviously that's most beneficial. You know, we say no one knows a relative like another relative. So, I mean, a lot of times, you know, especially with psychotic illnesses, they happen in the later stage of adolescence, you know, 18 to 21, a lot of times in college. So, you know, you start to see patterns that aren't normal. It's, you know, first I would ask the doctor, do you think maybe? And then I just think being able to communicate clearly with the loved one and saying, you know, that you're concerned about them, maybe we should come in and get this looked at. But, crisis mobile units, it's great that they're there. I mean, we hope those are last-ditch efforts to get care. We hope, you know, we know emergency rooms are a bit overwhelmed with psychiatric patients, but quite frankly, there's just not enough psychiatrists, and there's not enough pediatric psychiatrists. I mean, it's a countrywide epidemic right now, so that's unfortunately part of the problem too. But I think just being honest, communicating with the care providers that you have access to, and communicating with your loved one, and educating yourself, obviously. I mean, I've worked in NAMI since 2008, and a couple of years ago, we had to take my loved one who has serious bipolar disorder and didn't take their medication properly, and we had to, luckily, they're downstate and live right by New York Hospital, which has a great psychiatric emergency room, but, you know, that feeling of it's not like being in a regular emergency room, and when those doors close, it's a very scary feeling, both for, obviously, the person who's being inpatient, but for the family as well. It's just, you feel very hopeless, and education is power, as it is everything. And, you know, I'll tell you, turn to NAMI. We have many services available, and hopefully the psychiatric emergency room has one of our survival toolkits. Just open communication, I think, and education are the most important things for family members and people living with the illness.
And Linda, anything to add, maybe from the county, state side?
Warm lines and hotlines, opportunities for people to reach out and talk to someone else who also experiences this, is very helpful, and it keeps a person from becoming isolated and spiraling down. So any effort to talk about this, again, this is the stigma. If we can empower people about self-care and that it's okay to ask for help, I think that's a good first step.
Do you find, you mentioned, you know, online resources. I'm just wondering, there are many more ways to find out about what's out there now. But there are also many more ways to find out about all the things you should be scared of and all the things that might be wrong with you or your family member. Do you find there are sort of pluses and minuses to all those online resources that are available these days? Maybe Sean?
Yeah, I definitely think you can access a lot of help, but you can also get led astray, I think, into a lot of weird directions sometimes and start self-diagnosing or increase your anxiety with worrying about a lot of things that you might not need to worry about. And there's a lot of bad research or bad information about a lot of different things. So I think it's important to try to, you know, have an understanding of you know, what's good information.
We've batted around some of the challenges, but if I could just ask each of you to, you know, sum up what you think are the greatest challenges right now to mental health care delivery. Linda?
In this region, it's physician shortage. The workforce issue is, in my opinion, primary. We have hospitals who cannot stay open because they cannot get coverage, and it's at crisis proportion. Any type of mental health practitioner, we're utilizing nurse practitioners, psychiatric expertise. They can prescribe. They are wonderful. But the actual psychiatrist shortage, it's a national shortage, and that is really highlighted here in our region.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything Linda just said. You know, just not enough services. And you know, while we're very encouraged by what's going on with the new community system of care, we don't think that should come at a cost of having inpatient services. Like I said at the beginning, you know, mental illnesses really run the gamut, even within particular diseases. I mean, bipolar, for instance, is going to affect someone differently than it does somebody else. And, you know, somebody can recover great in the community with support, but the sickest of the sick need to have those services available to them. And that's something we're very worried about. We don't want to see those disappear. I mean, most of the calls that we get on our helpline are families desperate to find beds for their loved ones. I mean, we talked about safe and affordable housing, and a lot of people can have that, but some even need more. It's more supported housing and more the type of services you can only get within a hospital. I mean, you know, so we want to make sure that those outlets are still available to people.
And Sean?
Yeah, I agree with what they're saying with just lack of psychiatry, enough psychiatry, closing of inpatient beds. But I also think, you know, that there's more than just treatment with, you know, maintaining mental health. I think, you know, more focus on an overall quality of life for people, including housing, employment, education, socialization, social support if you don't have the family support, and overall wellness, physical health. These people overall have a much, you know, shorter lifespan than the rest of us. You know, what's going on with that? And all of those kinds of things, I think, need to be focused on in addition to just treatment.
Great. And finally, to conclude, what do you see on the horizon that gives you hope, whether it's medical research or something, you know, changes in the system or in education? What gives you the most hope for what we will see in the way mental health is treated in the years to come? Sean?
You know, I was very happy to see the funding that's coming through for housing. The response to that research I just mentioned about the 20-year shorter lifespan for people with mental illness was great. People seem to really pay attention to that. So I see a lot of focus on, you know, improving the physical health of this population and integrating care into a more seamless type of unit like we used to see with the state facilities, trying to replicate that out in the community, I hope would improve the system.
Great. And Matthew, I know you're involved in educating on medical research. What gives you hope?
Well, actually, I think this is a very exciting time. I think it's kind of a top-down approach. I mean, finally, we have a president and an administration who's truly invested in making research of the brain their top scientific priority, just like, you know, 50 years ago, President Kennedy made going to the moon his top scientific priority. Last year, the president held a major summit on mental health in the White House. We are seeing more initiatives and more money put into brain research, and those are things we're very excited about. On the state, and because Linda's sitting right next to me, we are excited about our new OMH commissioner, Dr. Sullivan, who comes from a practice background and really kind of understands these issues that we're talking about. So I think you're seeing from a top down a lot more investment into mental health and into brain research. So that's something we're very excited about.
Great. And Linda?
I'm most optimistic about the change in culture from where the doctor isn't always the expert, but the patient has more to offer to their own treatment on what they need. So the expansion of peers is vital. The integration of primary care and behavioral health, again, a more wellness model. I'm encouraged by the use of ancillary therapies, relaxation, yoga, nutrition, those kinds of softer sciences being used for people to feel better, and any model of prevention. You know, if it's early, it's really going to take a different form. So I'm encouraged by people being interested in mental health. Mental health is being invited to tables where we weren't usually members of the conversation. And I think that's a really encouraging start. We have to talk about it. We need each other to learn. And I think it's a wonderful time to do a systemic transformation.
Well, it's all about education is really what a lot of you were just speaking about boils down to. And hopefully this panel has been educational about this very large issue. I'd now like to open up the forum to questions from the audience. If you have a question, please step forward to the microphone over here. Identify yourself and let us know if you want to address your question to a particular panelist or to the panel as a whole.
My name is George Ebert, and I'm someone who was not invited to the table, nor were any of the people that I've worked with or represented in a particular human rights movement about human rights and mental health for the past 40 years. And I came to this expecting to hear that the current state of the of mental health in New York State is changing, but I'm finding hearing the same things that I've heard for 40 years, and I'm finding that we seem to be regressing in several areas, and particularly the way children are identified and talked out about now. And for many years, the State Office of Mental Health rejected the idea of children being mentally ill, that it was not good to stigmatize children like that, and talked about politically correct or language of children with serious emotional disturbances, and now I see it's back to mental illness, mental illness. And usually last year on Tuesday afternoons at 2 o'clock, my coworker and I we went to mental hygiene treatment over objection hearings in Syracuse every Tuesday afternoon, and there's something that I heard no mention of here and here, no mention of elsewhere. Each Tuesday afternoon in that medium-sized city, Syracuse, between 5 and 12 people were sentenced, court-ordered, to be psychiatrically drugged. And I had to stop going last fall. It was too much to hear week after week people begging not to be drugged. And the reason that people would be drugged is because they refused to talk to the psychiatrist about their childhood, or they knew the drug that was being ordered for them. They knew about it. It was not good for them, but it didn't matter. Every week in this region, our neighborhood, people who thought they might get some relief from the court that just wanted to be heard routinely were rubber stamped for forced treatment. Now, most of us know that what's going to happen, we don't approach the court. So I was disappointed that the reality of what mental health treatment, what psychiatric treatment is, wasn't brought out here. It was mentioned that people who've been treated, people with mental illness, die 20 years sooner than our contemporaries, but the research shows that it's more than 25% of people who have been treated in the public mental health system die an average of 25 years sooner than our brothers and sisters. People who have been treated and are not 99% of the people in the public mental health system on drugs or have had drugs, yes. So I saw a couple sentences I wrote in 2008, and it has to go with what people living with mental illness, people with mental illness, people are not with mental illness. We're not living with mental illness. We're talking about people who have been diagnosed, labeled, and stigmatized as being mentally ill. Most of us who have been treated as mentally ill were subjected to these powerful, unpleasant, often disabling drugs, shock treatment, often without our willing and informed consent, never with a truly informed consent, solitary confinement, and even brain destruction. And to refer to us always and forever as living with mental illness or having mental illness, suffering from mental illness, it adds insult to our injuries and perpetuates discrimination and stereotypes. I was disabled by psychiatrists with forced experimentation, forced drugging, shock treatment that I didn't want. I was disabled, so I because only they could say I was diseased. I was dehumanized, disregarded. Now, the Americans with Disabilities Act considers that I have a psychiatric disability. There was in the Office of Mental Health for many years talking, referring to people with psychiatric histories or psychiatric disabilities, but we're hearing the pushback to disease and mental illness again, and that we're going to need to be in treatment. The bias that we're hearing here towards a medical model, a disease model of human behavior, denies the reality and the suffering of people who have been subjective and often traumatic, invasive psychiatric procedures and other traumatic experiences. The lack of sensitivity for this to be happening in this... in the where we should be in our culture at this time, it has to end. I have children and grandchildren, and they are most vulnerable because of my history. And I'll stop. But the reality is that the psychiatric system does not treat us as human beings. It denies that we have a spirit. And
thank you for your comments, Linda. Did you want to? We did not talk about the court system at all, and obviously there is a role for the court system in this state, and it's been controversial. Did you want to address any of that?
It is controversial. George makes an excellent point about language and the sensitivity around language and this situation. Currently, we do have a system under the law called assisted outpatient treatment, which does, in fact, remove people's rights in order for the system to treat them. And that is highly controversial. Mm-hmm. So,
and Matthew, maybe you can also speak to the stigma and the language. And
well, yeah, I mean, let me first touch upon the assisted outpatient treatment, which is one of the most controversial laws in New York. You might know it as Kendra's Law, and basically, it says anyone who's a danger to themselves or others can be held within a mental health unit for I think 72 hours, right? You know, NAMI New York State does support AOT. It's the New York AOT has been clinically proven to be one of the most effective in the country, and the bottom line is it saves lives. You know, it's a very tough issue. You never want to impede on people's rights, but the bottom line is it does save lives. It saves, you know, it protects people living with an illness, and it protects the public at large. You know, the law was made because a woman, Kendra Webdale, was pushed in front of a subway in New York City, and the person who did it had schizophrenia and actually was looking for services earlier. That it's very similar to the case that you're hearing in Virginia with Senator Creed Deeds and his son Gus, who attacked the senator and killed himself. Earlier that day, they tried to get him into services, and you know they had him on a six-hour hold, but there just wasn't a bed available for him. And when someone's in a psychosis, the bottom line is they can't always make the best judgments. And, what psychosis is not seeing things realistically. So we are in favor of AOT. It does save lives, and it is effective. As far as language, I agree with a lot of what, George said. You know, I think you're going to put a negative on anything. I use the term a person living with a mental illness, and I don't see it any different than a person living with cancer or me as a person who's overweight. And, it's always a daily thing. And I think it's a better term. A lot of times when I first started NAMI, the term consumer was used a lot, and I never really understood where that came from or, someone suffering from a disease. Or the worst thing you do is you don't want to label people. Like, we're very against someone being called well, that person's a schizophrenic. You wouldn't put someone who has diabetes, you know, you do say they're diabetic, but that person isn't diabetic, you know what I mean? You don't ever want to label someone and stigmatize them. I personally think the most gentle way to put it is saying someone living with a mental illness. I think it's just kind of a black and white thing. So we do want to be careful how we don't want to label people and how we project the image of mental illness in the public.
And I think language is important in the way people are perceived, and it changes over time, for certainly. Does anyone else have a question? Yes.
My name is Ann Dox, and I feel kind of compelled to say, Matthew, that being held for 72 hours for an evaluation because you're deemed possibly a danger to yourself or others is not Kendra's law. So I just want to make that clear. Kendra's law and AOT is much more, there's a lot more components to it. It's more involved. That is not the same thing. So I just want to make that clear, perhaps to listeners. But George kind of introduced a lot of what I wanted to get at with my question, and that is that a lot of different language has been used here today, and it's confusing to me because I'm not sure what you're always talking about when you're using the different language. It's kind of mixed up to me. But I want to ask this question. Right now, the New York State Office of Mental Health serves approximately 76,000 people with services. Of those, over 90% identify as people who have experienced trauma. Most of those people come from childhood trauma situations. I identify as a trauma survivor. Where can this large percentage of people, and there's many others who won't go to the public mental health system for services, where do we go for help where we won't be identified as somebody who's mentally ill, where we will not get that label and put into that box of a diseased brain or some kind of disorder? Where can we get help? Trauma is rampant in New York State and around the world. So my question to all of you is, where do we go?
Trauma-informed care is much needed in all sections of the delivery system. Children entering the mental health system because of trauma, yeah, there's underlying issues. And until those underlying issues are addressed, is it really fair to label them with another diagnosis? I don't think so. And I don't think that's the usual course of what anybody intends, is to get a child into a system and keep them there, but get a child the right kind of help based on the age that the trauma occurred and the nature of the trauma. Yes, the labels are difficult. They do tend to follow people throughout a lifetime. We have to be very conscious and careful of that. Children, because of the developmental stages, you know, their behaviors show up so differently, and they can't even talk about it. So we need good experts trained in childhood development so that they can approach this. Often children learn by play, you know. Is there more we can do in play therapy?
Sean?
I just want to thank you for bringing that up because I think that was something that was missing from the discussion today. The correlation between trauma and all of these things is astounding, including not just the mental health diagnoses but the substance abuse issues. And trauma-informed care is a fantastic notion that there just isn't enough. Overall, there's not enough specialized care for a few things, trauma being one, geriatric populations I'm finding being another. I just think there needs to be a lot more training available to people like myself who maybe are doing outpatient therapy in trauma-informed care and really having very, very skilled professionals in order to you know, to address that the right way. And Linda, you mentioned, you know, interventions with children. I think the school system is just sitting there, you know, every child is interacting with all of these people at the school systems. And, you know, I think more work needs to be done on that level to intervene as soon as possible whenever these kinds of behavioral things or emotional problems are happening for children that could very well be linked to some kind of trauma. So, mm-hmm.
As far as children, I think a lot of good points you made, both of you, about learning. I mean, one term that we object to is like the term behavioral health. It makes it sound like someone's not doing something right, and that's why they're sick. So you can kind of talk about this forever, and it's kind of an endless, you know, using terminology and verbiage. But very good points about trauma. But we are making some headway with children's issues. Two things that just come immediately to mind. In Tompkins County, which they have the Whole Child Initiative, the Whole Child Checkup Initiative, which is something very exciting. And there's actually an Office of Mental Health Initiative called On Track New York, which came out of the NIMH Recovery After Initial Schizophrenic Episode study that Lisa Dixon was running down in Columbia University, where basically it's really aimed at children starting at 16. Like I said, a lot of these illnesses start at late adolescence, and it provides education, therapy, and job training for both the children, the adolescents, and their families. So we are starting to see more initiatives, more awareness. Schools are way behind, unfortunately. Obviously, the bullying issue, and we talk about trauma. I mean, that's a form of trauma, being bullied, and that's getting more attention now, but I think schools are still very behind the curve on that. That's why NAMI has programs such as Parents and Teachers as Allies that teach school administrators, educators, guidance counselors the realities about keeping children mentally healthy and the damages of bullying. You know, the old adage that sticks and stones will break our bones, but names will never hurt us, I think it's definitely been proven untrue, and it is very traumatic. And, you know, these are all these things that we're trying to address.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you brought up psychiatric services for the geriatric population, because that's a whole different, you know, form of treatment, because older people are dealing with a whole host of different physical issues, and so you have to treat psychiatric issues differently in that population. And I think a lot of people don't realize that. All right. Yes, your question.
I just have a few comments. My name is Felisa Letta. I'm a pharmacist, excuse me, at this facility. And I was wondering if there's any, they were adding on to the language, if they can get rid of the word normal, because mm-hmm. there is no normal. I would like that eliminated. And as far as the children, I think they need to be worked on more. They need more quiet time, gym time, play time, music therapy in schools. I'm trying to read my notes here. And more studies on vaccines and autism and preservatives. And that's all I have to say.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm a licensed mental health counselor, and I work at the infectious disease clinic at our Hobart Street site. And you mentioned an increase in the crisis services in the area. Can you tell me where we would go to get further information on that?
Your local government unit will have the updates on that. Your county Department of Mental Health will get that. Right now, this county is pretty well positioned with mobile services and interventions. Other counties don't have that. So I'm not expecting a huge shift in resources or services in this county.
Okay. So what we have right now with the mobile crisis assessment team, we basically have what we're going to have right now. So there won't be anything in addition.
There will be other things in addition to that, but I don't have a dollar amount, and I don't have the plans from this particular work group.
Okay.
And how they want it spent.
Okay. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, thank you very much for your questions. We appreciate them, and we appreciate you attending. And that concludes our forum on mental health care in upstate New York. I want to thank our panelists, Linda Nelson with the New York State Office of Mental Health, Matthew Shapiro with the New York Chapter of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, and Sean Johnston, a social worker at St. Elizabeth's Medical Center here in Utica. And thanks to producer and engineer Mark Lavonier, St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, for providing us with the facility to hold this forum, and particularly to Sandra Fentiman for helping us organize this. This is the third in our series of community forums on health topics that WRVO Public Media is holding throughout our listening region, and these forums are sponsored by the Health Foundation for Western and Central New York. I'm Catherine Loper. Thank you for joining this discussion on WRVO Public Media.